Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and welcome to Plant Wisdom. And I've been looking forward to this interview the way I used to look forward to Christmas when I was a small child. I got this book that we're going to be talking about with the author. I think the one came out. I love it on so many different levels. You're going to love it, too. It's called Southern Folk Medicine. And we're going to get into why this is such a significant book. But it's really... it's magnificent. It's a survey of this form of folk medicine, which is until recently not really too widely or well discussed. But it's also an amazing history of plant healing in the United States and in the Western Hemisphere, and how we have this unusual situation here where we have a fusion of all kinds of different cultures coming together and sharing information. And a lot of that sharing took place in the South, and a lot of it took place in Appalachia. And this is a very important part of our history that is not yet well known, but thanks to this book, and I hope other people that pick up this task, it's going to become much better known more widely. So with no further ado, let me introduce our guest today, Phyllis D. Light. Welcome, Phyllis.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Phyllis, this is such a great book on so many levels. First, it's interesting, and maybe we could talk about this a little bit as a way of introduction, just to learn about your family history and your upbringing and what life was and is like in your part of the world. It's a part of the world, Appalachia, that is not well understood. Sadly, it's not often well respected, and it should be better understood and better respected, and as we're going to find out in this call. But tell us a little bit about what life was like for you growing up in northern Alabama.
Well, northern Alabama is kind of a unique place because it's where the mountains, the lower range mountains of Appalachia, the foothills, meet the deep south. So, you know, I can drive an hour or two north, and I'm in the high mountains of North Georgia or North Carolina, and I can go an hour or two south, and I am in the plantation belt of the deep south. So it was kind of a unique place. And when I was growing up, cotton was king, and if a person had one flat acre of land, cotton was planted on it, because that was the only way to make any money. Mm-hmm. And even up here on the mountaintops, you know, the land would be contoured with various plowing techniques to make a flat enough spot to grow cotton. My family made their living. You know, one grandfather was a sharecropper and never owned any land, but he always, you know, rented and worked other people's land. And the houses they lived in always belonged to somebody else. And it was just that sharecropping culture. And so we had to work in the cotton fields and the corn fields. And he also supplemented income by hunting and, you know, of course, gardening and that sort of stuff. And then on the other side of the family, that was my mom's side of the family. On my dad's side of the family, they were loggers and foresters and herbal wildcrafters and healers. So it was like two different Southern cultures, but both here and both very much a part of the South for thousands and thousands of people. I mean, this was just our culture. So that's kind of the way it was when I was growing up. Lots of poverty, you know, nobody had indoor plumbing. Nobody, you know, it's okay. Mm-hmm. You got one pair of shoes a year, and the rest of the time you were barefooted. You know, it was just that extreme poverty that you can still find here. I mean, yeah, times have changed. The world is very digital and electronic and all that sort of thing. Cotton is no longer king. Sharecropping has changed. Now people are chicken farmers, and and you live on their land and work their chicken houses and a house trailer and instead of working the cotton fields, you know, there's been shifts, but there's a lot of things that have stayed the same. And one of the things in the Deep South and in parts of Appalachia is still the extreme poverty. That has not changed.
And you were in that cotton patch yourself picking cotton, yes?
Oh, yeah. You know, there we had, as kids, had our had what my grandfather called half a sack, and it was a short sack, you know, where my mom had a long sack. My mom could pack, oh, my God, she was a little skinny woman, but she could drag more than her weight in that cotton sack, fill it full of cotton, and drag it around the field. As kids had a short sack, and, you know, you might get 30, 40 pounds of cotton in it. But that was a lot when you were a little kid, and you would have to drag this around and pick. Everybody had to work. Everybody did, you know, because if you didn't share in the work, there it was like this team effort of survival. Everybody had to share in the work, or you might not survive. You weren't doing your part. If you weren't in the cotton field, you had to be in the garden. If you weren't in the garden, you had to be in the corn patch or the cornfield. You know, there was no laying around watching TV and somebody bringing you food. Right?
and the idea of back to the land was not a theory or an aspiration. It was your daily reality.
It was totally the reality.
And then the other piece, of this, which you point out in your book, which is, it's one of these common sense things that people don't think about. You know, first of all, millions of people all over the world live this way, and they don't have doctors, they don't have hospitals, they don't have the EMT showing up at the door if there's a problem. They don't have, and if they could get to the doctor, they may not even have the money to pay the doctor. So people have to keep themselves together on a very high level of functioning and health. Now, because as you pointed out, it's survival. This is not a theoretical thing. This is, we're trying to survive here. So letting one's health deteriorate, not knowing how to take care of one's health, not really an option. Yeah. So when we think about, so now if we put our thinking caps on here, everybody, we've got people who've got to work physically hard, really hard, or their family may not make it. They don't have access to all the so-called benefits we have. They don't have access to the medical system. So how did they do it? How did they survive? And part of the answer is in your book, Phyllis. Tell us a little bit about the culture of natural healing and folk medicine. It's just a sort of a broad overview, and then we'll get to some of the specifics.
Okay. Well, I also want to point out that if you were sick, you were still expected to work. That saying, oh, my joints hurt or I have a headache, that didn't fly. It was still get your pick sack and get out there. You didn't get a free ride.
Wow.
You had to be like fever, throwing up, can't move, massive diarrhea or something before you got to stay home and not work.
Wow. I have traveled around the world a bit, and I remember being way in the backwoods of Guatemala, and that's the life there. Everybody's working hard. Everybody's hauling heavy stuff. Families go out and gather wood, and it takes them the better part of the morning to get their wood for the day, because there's no other fuel. And then they have a full day of heavy duty lifting. I'll just tell this quick story that I was way up in the mountains of El Salvador, and we were humping it. We're breathing hard and having trouble. And all of a sudden, two guys come running down the mountain, and they've got on their backs wood, but big pieces of wood, not twigs, like their weight or heavier, attached, you know, by a headband and on their back, running down the mountain. And I asked the guy, what's that all about? He goes, oh, they're wood gatherers. I say, and then I go, where are they getting the wood? And he pointed to mountains that were even further away than we were, like miles beyond and higher up. And I can't even imagine lifting that wood myself, let alone running with it. And then I said to them, how many times do they do that a day? Three times these guys walk all the way to the top of those mountains, bring down the wood, run it down, run back, run it down. And I asked, how do they make a day? $10 a day.
Wow.
So this is a physical reality for a whole lot of people. And how are these people keeping themselves together? They're not at $10 a day. You're not going to the fancy hospital in Guatemala City if you have a hiccup. Tell us about the depth of knowledge that lives that in the Appalachians.
Well, during this time period, because this has changed, this is of course all changing now. First and foremost, your food was your medicine. Mm. And all these home remedies often evolved, number one, around kitchen remedies, and what to cook and what, if you had it on hand. And then, fortunately, everybody's growing what they're eating, and even though people are in poverty, the soil is lush, and if you throw a seed out there, you're going to grow something. Mm-hmm. And so people did grow good garden foods, and gardens were absolutely necessary for life, not just to grow what you were eating in the moment, but to preserve it. People raised pigs and cows and chickens and hunted, and wild game was a very important part of this. I can share my grandmother's recipe for squirrel dumplings. There was, so you had to work hard, but food was considered, you had to eat for your job too.
Mm-hmm.
You had to eat to expend energy. So, there's all these kitchen remedies, which are coming out in my next book, around using potatoes and cabbage and how they, like potato, cut a potato in half and put it on a splinter and it just draws it right out. So there were all these remedies that were passed from with the women in the family. And this is another thing that's fading that I hope to share more about in a future book, is we're missing this generational energy. Information.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were the herbal remedies. So if the kitchen remedies, if the home remedies didn't work, then you move to the herbal remedies. And the herbal remedies involved a little bit more specific knowledge. And sometimes this was within the family, but most often they had to go outside the family to the local herbalist or the local, as I say in my book, we called the folks herb doctors back then.
Mm-hmm.
Can't do that anymore, but you went to the local herb doctor or the local mm-hmm. midwife. So higher level of knowledge there. And those were kind of the two. You had the home remedies and you had the special information. And so this is what, and you had, of course, the base of that was your food.
Gotcha. And even though people were poor, they may well have been eating better than the average American today because they were eating things that they'd grown and things that they'd caught fresh.
Exactly.
And they weren't eating. There wasn't the local convenience store with the 10-pound bag of potato chips.
No.
Or the 2-gallon drink.
Right.
I remember talking to a fellow that grew up in Louisiana, and African American and very poor family, but the community had a full acre vegetable garden, and everybody was eating from that, and he was as healthy as a horse, as were all the kids. So let's talk about the elements that go in to Southern folk medicine. One of the things I found so fascinating about your book, and you document it so well, is it's like they like to say in Louisiana, it's really a gumbo. You had the people from England who had their folk tradition. And remember, everybody used to live this way. This is, you know,
right.
now may most, you know, we might have a big pocket of modern people, but a lot of people are still living this way. But in the past, anyone listening to this, I'm sure you will not have to go back too many generations before you have people in your family tree who this was their daily reality. So every part of the world had a food and herbal healing tradition that worked. Because if it didn't work, we wouldn't be having this conversation today. We wouldn't have made it. So
right.
England had one, and they contributed, of course, to the mix. The Native Americans who were already there contributed. African Americans who found their way, to the Appalachians, they contributed. Irish people, you mentioned the special role of Irish people, which I was not aware that so many Irish people started out in the Caribbean, and then when they were freed, and by the way, Irish people were enslaved too, in a different system, but it wasn't very nice and it wasn't very pretty. And when they were freed from those horrible sugar plantations and sugar mills, assuming they survived, because as you point out, this is important history, they were intended to be worked to death. There was
right.
no desire. It was economically calculated that we could just get more of those people, so just work them to death. But when the Irish people, many of whom started out in the Caribbean, were freed, they made their way to the South. So we had that. So you have this incredible coming together of all kinds of different cultures. And if you wouldn't mind detailing one aspect of this, which I found so interesting, that during the Trail of Tears, which a lot of people think was related just to the Cherokees, it actually related to all the people, Native people living in the Southeast. They were all, you know, captured and force migrated out of the area. Your part of the world became sort of a refuge for many different Native peoples. Can you just talk a little bit about that history? I think that's so fascinating.
Yeah, sure. I think we focus on the Cherokees because they were the last tribe that went. But, you know, the Choctaw and Chickasaw 5 years before were one of the first tribes. They were the first tribes that were moved. And so where I live, as I said, the mountains kind of connect to the foothills, which connect to the plains or to the prairie. In Alabama, it was the prairie, which was plantation area. And the Tennessee River cuts across the whole state of Alabama from the northeast corner to the northwest corner, kind of dips down and follows the edge of the mountains. And so, like, I still live here, and, like, the river's, like, 15 minutes from my house by driving. Mm. Down to it. The Native Americans from further north, from the Carolinas and parts of Kentucky, Tennessee, were taken to, you know, like Knoxville, and they were put on barges on the river because they thought this would be one of the faster ways to get them. Or they were taken overland to Chattanooga, which was another river port. And then in Alabama, Gunnersville, which is what is close to my house, is in the Big Bend of the Tennessee River. And so there was like a holding stockade here. So Native Americans would filter down either overland or on barges on the river to stockades or holding reservations in Gunnersville. And then they would like barge them down the river to Waterloo, Alabama. I always thought that was a name. And then they would disembark for a bit of an overland walk. And then the Tennessee connects into the Ohio, and the Ohio connects into the Mississippi. And that's how they would cross and be in Arkansas or Oklahoma. Also, Waterloo, Alabama is not that far from Memphis, and Memphis, Tennessee is another like crossing over the Mississippi River. And then Arkansas is on the other side. So sometimes they would barge them across the Mississippi there at Memphis, and which is why you have so many kind of reservations in a certain part of Arkansas. There's just like one right after the other. Because this is where they ended up. If you ever do Interstate, I think it's 40 from Memphis through Arkansas, you'll go reservation, reservation, reservation. And then Oklahoma. And then they took some of them down the river, which is why you end up with Louisiana having, back in the day, some reservations. And then they filtered over into kind of Texas, northern Texas from there. But anyway, where I lived, it was the longest stretch of river. Like I say, all the way across the state. And so the Tennessee River went dry. It was a drought year, and they couldn't barge the Native Americans down the river, and so they just kept holding them. And they, to make an overland route, they had to make the route. I mean, there was no road that followed the river. Do you get what I mean? So
yeah,
they were
sure.
having to create a road as they went. And so what happened was a lot of the Native Americans just went, crap this, I'm just leaving. And so they ran off into all the hills and hollers of North Alabama.
Uh-huh.
And they just escaped. And the hills and hollers here are not as tall as you're going to get in northern Georgia or in North Carolina, but there are a lot of them. There are a whole lot of them. And so they could just stay back in these little holler hill areas, and they couldn't be found. So we ended up with, like, a huge number of Native Americans here from various tribes who ended up kind of, like, intermarrying and coming together just because they escaped. And a lot of people in North Alabama can trace their Native American heritage back to those many generations to that escape group of Native Americans. And there were hundreds that escaped.
And so all that, so the herbal knowledge, or a lot of herbal knowledge from many, many different tribes and nations found its way into northern Alabama, found a home in northern Alabama.
Right. And remember, these are, when we say many tribes or nations, these are southeastern Native Americans.
Right, right.
Let's keep it, that's the region.
Right, right. And then another dimension to this, which is so interesting, is that when the African people were brought over as slaves, kidnapped and terrorized and brought over here, a lot of them escaped too. Some of them ended up in the mountains, a good place to hide. But also there was a lot of communication between African, then African, now African Americans, because they were not in America now, and Native people. They were for two reasons. One, they were both in this kind of in the same boat, being oppressed. But second, they were both earth-based people who were very sophisticated about plants and herbal medicine, and they had things to teach each other. And it was probably, I know that Africans did manage to bring over a fair amount of agricultural things, including seeds, believe it or not.
Right.
Now, but they couldn't, obviously they couldn't bring the forest with them. So they had to learn the existing forest from the native people. And they were completely equipped to learn. It would be like one scholar visiting with another scholar. They're in the same zone, right? So they can talk.
Right.
So you have that mix. I'm going to ask you to tell another story, if you don't mind. The Irish dimension to this, you know, my last name is McCarthy, so I'm interested in this. The Irish dimension of this is so interesting. You said in the book that people know this to a degree, that there was a huge catastrophe in Ireland in the 19th century, a famine that was politically enforced, and hundreds of thousands of people disappeared either by dying or nobody really knows how many people. It's certainly well over a million. Nobody knows the disposition of all of them. Some of them ended up in the Caribbean, you know, working under terrible conditions. Some of them ended up going to North America. Some of them died. But you mentioned that the exodus was so significant that Ireland lost a lot of its natural healing health infrastructure.
Right. And that was in the 17th century, the 1600s.
I'm sorry, 1700s, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and then there was the last wave of Irish were in the 1800s. So we had like two big waves. But the one you're talking about was where the English were trying, so England had become overpopulated and there were like no jobs or nothing that second and third sons of wealthy families could do. And there were a lot of poor also, you know, in the cities in England. So England decided to take over Ireland, and I'm leaving out the big religious discussion that is also taking place, because Ireland tended to be Catholic, and at that time period, a Protestant was on the throne. And so yep. We have this Protestant Catholic or papal thing kind of going on too. And so England decided, well, we're going to get rid of all the Catholics in Ireland while at the same time getting their land so that that we could put our second and third sons to oversee them and give them an opportunity. And, of course, some of those second and third sons were also bringing money to America, to the United States, and starting plantations here. So, you know, it was like that was going on, too. So the first year, and in Ireland, this went on over 100 years, and I'm really simplifying this because it's quite complex with all the history. Ireland was really hard to conquer because it was still set up like fiefdoms, so mm-hmm. And clan, and so was Scotland. So you had the clan, the castle, and then all the land around and the people who worked the land. And your loyalty was to your clan and to the clan holder. And so it was hard to conquer because you had to go from castle to castle. It wasn't like you could go invade a city and call it done, right?
Right.
And so it took a lot of years. And so the healers were attached to the clan. So if the clan had to leave or the clan holder had to leave, well, the healer, that was where the healer went. And so
Okay. There
was an exodus to the Caribbean. There's an exodus to, of course, the indenturedness. And then there was an exodus to France because France was taking in a lot of the Irish wealthy at that time. Because France and England always fought each other, and France was doing it just to piss England off. Oh.
Uh-huh.
That's a kiss? Okay. So that was taking place at the time, and by the time it was over, the Irish that didn't flee the first year there was like England said, you can leave of your own free will, and then the ones that didn't leave, because they were really attached to their land.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't think all indigenous cultures, and I'm including Irish in, at this time period as indigenous because they loved their land so much. It was all land-based, everything. They didn't want to leave the land of their ancestors. You don't want to leave the place your ancestors are buried, where their bones are in the ground. And mm-hmm. the Africans had the same kind of thought. You know, I'm no longer in the land of my ancestors. There's no bones here.
Mm-hmm.
They ended up either killing them, starving them, or creating, at this time period, England created the plantation system, and that's what they called it,
mm-hmm.
in Ireland. And the Irish that were left, and there were less than a million left by the time it was all over, were in servitude to land under the plantation system. The ones that were left. So then England later brought that system to the South, and that's where we get the plantation system. And initially in the South, they tried to use Native Americans as their slave labor. Two big problems with that. One is Native Americans were like, I'm not staying here, I'm running off. And so then when they tried shackling them, what happened was the Native Americans just died of European diseases. So they couldn't use Native Americans. So this is when one of the reasons Africans were brought over. Africans had already been pretty much exposed to those childhood diseases and didn't die when they got them. And so that was a big financial impetus around getting in Africans for the plantation system instead of using Native Americans. But that was one of the stories of the Irish, and that was the first wave. The second wave came in around the Civil War time. And so what would happen is America, I'm trying to figure out how to say this, Northern, because the country was divided between the North and South. So yep. The North would, you know, sent these like flyers to Ireland going, hey, come on over, we have free land. So there was this push during this time period west of the Mississippi. You can get land in Kansas. You can get land in Oklahoma. You can get land in Ohio. There's all this free land if you'll come over. So what happened was all these Irish began to come over, and as soon as they got off the boat, the Union Army conscripted them into service and said, you have to serve in our army, and then you get your land.
Wow. Bait and switch.
Bait and switch. So that was the second wave of Irish, and that was kind of like the last layer in Appalachia. And so, and the Irish brought their, it wasn't just young Irish males, you know, whole families would come over. Mm-hmm. And grandfathers, grandmothers, husbands, wives, kids, because it was, you know, it was their opportunity to own some land. And this was like the most important thing. To own a little acre of land was the most important thing in the world to the Irish, because it said, you are a land owner, right? And so that was the last wave of Irish that made their way down through the Cumberland Gap into the Appalachians. And so that was the last layer in Southern folk medicine. I will say the Irish and the Scots, and Scots-Irish, would like make their way down to Appalachia. They would go across North Alabama because they were going, oh, Appalachia's now getting too crowded. to the hill country of Texas, which is another big area. And then they made their way over into the Cascade Mountains in the Northwest. That was like these, and on their way, they stopped off, you know, in Arkansas. So this is why we have these, like, seemingly Appalachian cultures in these other states. That was the route of settlement. And so you have quilting, just as an example. You have quilting in North Carolina. You have quilting in Arkansas. You have quilting and Cascade Mountains. And quilting came from the Irish, you know, poor Irish. She said, we have to stay warm and we don't have anything. Let's put these scraps together.
Okay.
You know, and I'm not saying that other cultures didn't quilt also, but this is in the Appalachians, kind of where we got it. And then so when quilting got here, let's put all these scraps together. And now we have cotton. Let's make the lining out of cotton.
Gotcha. So I think listeners are getting the picture that this part of the world was just a true melting pot of traditional cultures, various Native American tribes and people, various African tribes and people, because it was, you know, we talk about Africa, but really, you know, when we talk about Africa, we're talking about thousands of different subgroups and languages.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
lot of different African cultures, and then the culture of the British Islands, and then the culture of Ireland, and I might be leaving some group out, all came together in your neck of the woods, and this fusion of knowledge took place. And you're one of the beneficiaries of that. Your family had herbal knowledge and plant healing knowledge going back how many generations?
Gosh, I don't know. So like my grandmother who taught me, my grandmother, and this is on my dad's side of the family, she got taught by her mother and grandmother who were alive during the Civil War. And past the Civil War, I don't know, but I can trace things back to the Civil. So that would be like 1865. I can trace things back to over how many generations that is. Before the Civil War, there's just no record, so I don't know.
Gotcha. I'm in the same boat. We have the Irish side of my family, we have absolutely no idea how we got here.
Right. And my dad's side of family is where there was some Native American heritage. And So I do have within the family some Trail of Tears stories that got passed on. So that takes us back into the 1830s.
Gotcha. Now, your training in these things started very early. You went out with your dad, who was an expert at finding the, I'm drawing a blank on the root, the ginseng root.
Ginseng, yeah. Yeah, you know, I was out in the woods by the time I was 5, 6, 7, but my serious training didn't start till I was 10.
You had to wait till you were 10 for the serious stuff.
And then
you had an apprenticeship, relationship, teacher student with a very well who became very well known later as an expert in these matters. Can you talk a little about him?
Tommy Bass.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Tommy lived exactly an hour from me, driving 50 miles north. So he was up in the higher mountains of Alabama. You know, so. His culture and his family had come over from England, and so he still in recent memory, so he still had that relationship with the old country through stories and everything. So he lived up at Sandrock, Alabama. And he actually started when he was 5, the serious, pretty serious stuff. He didn't get the serious stuff, he said, till he was 7. So because that was their total way of life. Tommy was just amazing. This is all he ever did with his life. He had, again, it was a fusion for him. His family brought quite a number of old family recipes over from England. His grandparents did when they came. And then at the foot of the mountain where he lived was the river. And Aunt Molly Kirby was what everybody called her, was an African-American midwife. And one of his first jobs was to gather the roots and herbs for her out of the woods because she couldn't get up and down the mountains anymore and she couldn't get anybody else to do it. He trained under her. He trained under his parents. There was a Native American healer up in the area that he trained. Again, it's this fusion. And so Tommy said one of his first big lessons in healing came, somebody can probably pinpoint this time period a little better, 1914 or 15, somewhere 17, somewhere in there, when that horrible swine flu went through and killed millions of people around the world.
The great influenza, they called it?
Yes.
That would have been 1918.
1918. Okay.
Yeah.
So Tommy said every single member of his family got that but him.
Wow.
And it would just swept through the community. And for some reason, and he was like, I don't know, 8 or 9 at the time. He was young at that time. He was the person that had to go out and get the herbs and make up the brews and make sure his family and community didn't die. Hey, that's a lot of responsibility for a little kid.
Sure.
I can't imagine any little kids these days having the responsible approach, the drive, the passion, the inner knowing that this is what you've got to do to save your community and your life. And he ministered to his family. He didn't lose a person. Into his community as best he could, you know, and it was horrible and it killed people. But he never forgot the people that died during that and what I just couldn't save them. I mean, it was like really imprinted on him. And that's all he ever did. He never went to school. His mom taught him to read out of the Bible and gathered herbs and hunted and did animal pelts and logged. It worked in the cotton fields. You know, again, cotton's king, but it's seasonal work. And ministered to his community his whole life. And he died in 1996. And he became really famous because he helped heal somebody. He had some connection with the Wall Street Journal, and they came down and did a big expose on him and his country healing ways, and suddenly he's plastered all over the world. And he was just such a good person. He just handled all that. Suddenly there were like hundreds of people coming to see him. One year that I worked with him, we saw like 3,000 people.
Wow.
That is an herbal practice. And I just
wow.
got tired of keeping up with people. I'm like, okay. All right. It's like, there could have been more the next year. I mean, he was just amazing. But I have never, ever met, and I have met some really good woods herbalists who would take you out and do a plant walk and go, hey, that's that tree. That's what you use it for. I never met anybody that came close to Tommy, ever.
In terms of his familiarity and intimacy with the woods.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And he, even in his 70s, he never learned to drive, so you had to take him everywhere. We'd be going down the road, and he would look out, and he'd go, there's a pin oak tree up there. And I'm like, where?
Yeah,
where? Right? And, you know, it's like way up the road. I can't even see it yet. And he's already spotted it. I mean, he was leaf shape. He just knew the herbs of the wood. But if that's all you've been doing since you're 5, I mean, you're an encyclopedia, and he truly was. I've never been able to come close. And, you know, and I can probably do several hundred plants in the local woods. But he could do several thousand.
Wow.
Literally.
Which brings us to this issue. Are there any people left like him, you know, or are we dealing with the remnants of something that was much bigger and greater?
I think there are the people left like him are few and far in between, and they're not getting the publicity that he did. So we probably don't know. One of my goals over the years has been to find these people. And every time somebody says, oh, there's an old man or an old woman, I'm like, where? And I'm trying to find them. Mm. Just because here's an encyclopedia that's about to die. Let's get it. You know, let's try to get that information. You know?
You know, it's funny. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So they're the holders of this traditional wisdom, and we're not honoring them or respecting them or believing in them, and we're not seeking them. And, you know, and why not? Let's try to get that.
You know, it's funny. We have people going, you know, to the deepest, darkest corners of the Amazon, you know, to do this kind of research, and they don't even have to get on a plane. If somebody wants to save traditional plant wisdom, and they live in the United States, they don't have to even get on a plane.
But no, they don't.
It's here. It's still here.
It's here.
But it has to be preserved. You know, we've talked a lot about Phyllis's background and all the elements that went into the making of Southern folk medicine. We haven't really had a chance to talk about the medicine itself. That's in the book. It's called Southern Folk Medicine by Phyllis D. Light. I'm going to have a link below. I strongly recommend you get it. One of the big things you're going to get in this book, and maybe Phyllis, we can end by talking on this particular point, is that just like the Chinese medicine system and the ancient Greek medicine system and the Ayurvedic, in Southern folk medicine, there is I'm going to call it a theory of humors. I don't know if that's the right way to say it, but can you talk a little bit about that? Just an overview, because it's really, folks, it's really quite extensive, and Phyllis details it very well in the book, but maybe you could just introduce the topic to our listeners now.
Yeah, because Southern folk medicine was this fusion of different systems and cultures, there is an aspect of humoral or Greek medicine in it, because that's what the folks from the British Isles brought to the South was, you know, because humoral medicine was the medicine in the British Isles at the time. But Native Americans also had something similar. They didn't call it humoral medicine. It was an elemental theory, you know, based on the elements. So Native Americans at this time in the South, as I was taught, and that's all I can say, because every tribe was different, and I can't say all Native Americans, but I can only say what I was taught from this, is based on the elements. So, you know, you had the wind, and you had the earth, and the fire, and the water. And so this elemental approach sort of fused with a humoral approach and created something unique, because it's not the humoral approach anymore. I mean, it's totally different from that. I've talked to some folks from England and folks who have studied humoral medicine, and it's not exactly it, but there are elements in there. And it's not, like I say, it's a fusion. So, you know, you have the element and you have the fluid that goes with the element, based on this fusion approach. And the element was important. And as I was taught, of all the elements, the wind is the only one that can move. It's right. So fire burns, but you run out of fuel and the fire's dead. Water flows, but you can dam that up really easy. You can have a drought, you know. So it doesn't have a life of its own. The earth is pretty fixed, but the wind has a life. The wind is animated. The wind moves. The wind carries all this stuff. So there is this elemental approach, and you can say wind, air, either one. That went along, that got fused into Southern folk medicine. And it's really kind of fascinating. So I grew up being taught, there's fire in the blood. And this element approach was just part of our everyday language. And unfortunately, it's just fading away, being replaced by a digital language. But it was such an earth-based language when I was growing up. There were all these sayings about the elements. You know, you eat beans, you pass wind, right? You know, somebody that was very creative had a lot of fire in their blood. And people would just say it, you know, oh, man, that person got a lot of fire. And you knew exactly what they meant. You knew it, everything. That said like 5 pages of information about that person. If somebody said, oh, they have a lot of fire.
Yeah.
You knew,
yeah.
You know, right? That's half your assessment right there. Right.
So it was part of our everyday consciousness, and then you in the book get into great detail and depth on the different humors, whether it's water, wind, earth, and how each constitution type is different, how it needs to be treated differently, how different organ systems are related to different elements, and it's so for you know we're always in awe of Chinese medicine and how they do something kind of similar, but here we have this right here in the United States, this different but similar approach to helping and enhancing human health. So you go into this in great detail in the book, and anybody that wants to dive deeper into this subject to get an appreciation of the richness of Southern folk medicine, all the different elements that were included in its creation. And we're talking about its creation as if it's some solid, fixed thing. It's actually a web of knowledge that's in the minds and bodies of people, you know?
Right.
And you're kind of one of the first people to put all this in a book, by the way. I should have started out our interview by saying that. This has been knowledge that's been embodied in people, but not really in the books.
True. But I will say that a lot of my documentation, because people are like, where did you get this? And you can say oral all day long, and it cures a certain amount of weight, and it is true, but it was also documented in sociological studies.
Interesting.
Not in healing studies. So a lot of, there's a vast number of resources I used to write the book, but one of them was President Roosevelt created the WPA, and part of the WPA during the Depression, he thought was important is he sent people around all over the country documenting folk life, because he could see that it was going to be gone. So, and then President Carter did the same thing.
Oh,
yeah.
Didn't realize that.
So, yes. So there were two big sources of information. So the WPA, this is when we have the slave narratives that have been recorded.
Gotcha.
Right? And there's a vast amount of information in those narratives. But they also sent people around to Appalachia and Arkansas and these other holders of this fusion of information along with the slave narratives. It's all there. I mean, it's amazing documentation. There's recordings. You can get on the Smithsonian and listen to it. There are books. All right, so then let's go to the 70s, I guess. Where, again, sociologists were kind of sent out to capture the last of this folk culture. And folk culture became very popular during this time period. Folk art was exonerated. Folk artists. But this healing information was also written down and captured in books and, again, in papers. So it's... there's a lot of documentation in the 1900s that says, oh, here's the elements in Southern folk medicine. Here's how they use fluids. It's there. And the documentation were interviews sociologists did with traditional healers and then wrote that down. Yeah.
But you're one of the first people to take all those pieces and put them together in a book with a historical overview and a theoretical overview so that people can see the system in one book as opposed
and
to having to go
use it.
And there we go.
And we're going to lose it.
Yep. Speaking of using it, you teach this subject. Can you tell? Let's end
in
this.
My practice.
And in your practice, let's end with perhaps you describing educational opportunities for people who get the book and read it and are intrigued and say, "Wow, I want to go deeper into this." How does that work if someone wants to learn more about?
I have an herb school in Arab, Alabama. You can come to that. I am going to start an online program in April. You can sign up for that. I travel around the country teaching about it. Catch me at a conference or invite me to come and speak to your conference or to your group of people. You get a group of people together. I just want people to, number one, know how easy it is to use. It's not hard. Mm-hmm. Once you move in, you know, if you relax and go, oh, this is the language my grandmother used, and this is what my grandmother meant, you already know how to use it. You already know half of it.
Okay.
You may not know the history, but it's a vocabulary you already know. You don't have to learn a new vocabulary. Because the vocabulary is based on the common language of poor people.
Okay.
Easy. And so I want people to understand how quick and easy it is to pick up and use and how super useful it is when you do. It just gets for yourself, your family, your practice, really easy to use and super useful. As I said, if I understand a person's constitution, that's half of the information I need right there for either a consultation or just to help them at all. So I don't know what else to say there.
Okay. Well, people can go to your website, which is Phyllis D. Light. Is that correct?
Yes.
.com.
Yes, it is.
So I'm going to spell that out. It's PHYLLIS, the letter D as in David, Light, LIGHT, Phyllis D. Light.com. And they can sign up for your mailing list and find out about places where you're speaking, find about the online course when it starts to come out in April. In the meantime, I strongly recommend if you have any interest at all, I know everybody listening does, in plant wisdom, there's this great wet reservoir of plant wisdom right here in the United States, in the Appalachians, in everywhere, but in the hills of northern Alabama in particular, and documented beautifully. This is a magnificent book. I want to go back to what I said at the beginning. This is such an interesting book on so many levels. It's very human. It also gives you a great understanding of American history that you might not have gotten from other sources. And then it introduces you to this way of healing, which has proven itself in the crucible of time. Remember, this is the medicine, I don't know if we can use that term, the healing practices of people who were without the normal resources, living very demanding lives, very physically challenging lives, without access to a lot of or any advantages that we take for granted. And somehow they not only managed to survive, they thrived for centuries. And all these folks, Africans, Native people, people from the British Islands, people from Ireland, all found themselves together in this beautiful part of the world, and they figured it out. And Phyllis D. Light's got it in the book Southern Folk Medicine. I hope everybody checks it out. And it's one of the best plant books I've read in many, many years, so I recommend it very highly. Well, Phyllis, thank you so much for joining us for this hour. It turned out to be an hour after all. I hope you had fun. I certainly did.
Yes. And thank you so much for inviting me. I appreciate that.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. All right, that's Ken McCarthy for plantwisdom.org.
Thank you. Bye.